over a large landmass. They could be any sort of animal, but let's carry on thinking of shrews. The landmass is cut in two by a mountain range. This is hostile country and the shrews are unlikely to cross it, but it's not quite impossible, and very occasionally one or two do end up in the lowlands on the other side. Here they can flourish, and they give rise to an outlying population of the species, effectively cut off from the main population. Now the two populations breed, and breed separately, mixing their genes on each side of the mountains but not across the mountains. As time goes by, any changes in the genetic composition of one population are spread by breeding throughout that population, but not across to the other population. Some of these changes may be brought about by natural selection, which may be different on the two sides of the mountain range. We should hardly expect weather conditions and predators and parasites to be exactly the same on the two sides. Some of the changes may be due to chance alone. Whatever the genetic changes are due to, breeding tends to spread them within each of the two populations, but not between the two populations. So the two populations diverge genetically. They become progressively more unlike each other. They become so unlike each other that after a while, naturalists would see them as belonging to different races. After a longer time, they will have diverged so far that we should classify them as different species. Now imagine that the climate warms up so that travel through the mountain passes becomes easier and some of the new species start trickling back to their ancestral homelands. When they meet the descendants of their long-lost cousins, it turns out that they've diverged so far in their genetic makeup that they can no longer successfully interbreed with them. If they do hybridize with them, the resulting offspring are sickly or sterile, like mules. So natural selection penalizes any predilection on the part of individuals on either side towards hybridizing with the other species or even race. Natural selection thereby finishes off the process of reproductive isolation that began with the chance intervention of a mountain range. Speciation is complete. We now have two species where previously there was one, and the two species can coexist in the same area without interbreeding with one another. Actually, the likelihood is that the two species would not coexist for very long. This is not because they would interbreed, but because they would compete. It is a widely accepted principle of ecology that two species with the same way of life will not coexist for long in one place because they will compete and one or other will be driven extinct. Of course, our two populations of shrews might no longer have the same way of life. For instance, the new species, during its period of evolution on the other side of the mountains, might have come to specialize on a different kind of insect prey. But if there is significant competition between the two species, most ecologists would expect one or other species to go extinct in the area of overlap. If it happened to be the original ancestral species that was driven extinct, we should say that it had been replaced by the new immigrant species.
The theory of speciation resulting from initial geographical separation has long been a cornerstone of mainstream orthodox neo-Darwinism, and it is still accepted on all sides as the main process by which new species come into existence. Some people think there are others as well. Its incorporation into modern Darwinism was largely due to the influence of the distinguished zoologist Ernst Mayr. What the punctuationists did when they first proposed their theory was to ask themselves, given that, like most neo-Darwinians, we accept the orthodox theory that speciation starts with geographical isolation, what should we expect to see in the fossil record? Recall the hypothetical population of shrews, with a new species diverging on the far side of a mountain range, then eventually returning to the ancestral homelands, and quite possibly driving the ancestral species extinct. Suppose that these shrews had left fossils. Suppose even that the fossil record was perfect, with no gaps due to the unfortunate omission of key stages. What should we expect these fossils to show us? A smooth transition from ancestral species to daughter species? Certainly not, at least if we're digging in the main landmass where the original ancestral shrews lived and to which the new species returned. Think of the history of what actually happened in the main landmass. There were the ancestral shrews living and breeding happily away with no particular reason to change. Admittedly, their cousins the other side of the mountains were busy evolving, but their fossils are all on the other side of the mountain, so we don't find them in the main landmass where we are digging. Then, suddenly by geological standards, that is, the new species returns, competes with the main species, and perhaps replaces the main species. Suddenly, the fossils that we find as we move up through the strata of the main landmass change. Previously, they were all of the ancestral species. Now, abruptly and without visible transitions, fossils of the new species appear, and fossils of the old species disappear. The gaps, far from being annoying imperfections or awkward embarrassments, turn out to be exactly what we should positively expect if we take seriously our orthodox neo-Darwinian theory of speciation. The reason the transition from ancestral species to descendant species appears to be abrupt and jerky is simply that when we look at a series of fossils from any one place, we are probably not looking at an evolutionary event at all. We are looking at a migrational event, the arrival of a new species from another geographical area. Certainly there were evolutionary events, and one species really did evolve, probably gradually, from another. But in order to see the evolutionary transition documented in the fossils, we should have to dig elsewhere, in this case, on the other side of the mountains. The point that Eldred and Gould were making then could have been modestly presented as a helpful rescuing of Darwin and his successors from what had seemed to them an awkward difficulty. Indeed, that is, at least in part, how it was presented, initially. Darwinians had always been bothered by the apparent gappiness of the fossil record, and had seemed forced to resort to special pleading about imperfect evidence. Darwin himself had written,
"The geological record is extremely imperfect, and this fact will, to a large extent, explain why we do not find interminable varieties connecting together all the extinct and existing forms of life by the finest graduated steps. He who rejects these views on the nature of the geological record will rightly reject my whole theory."
Eldred and Gould could have made this their main message. Don't worry, Darwin, even if the fossil record were perfect, you shouldn't expect to see a finely graduated progression if you only dig in one place, for the simple reason that most of the evolutionary change took place somewhere else. They could have gone further and said,
"Darwin, when you said that the fossil record was imperfect, you were understating it. Not only is it imperfect, there are good reasons for expecting it to be particularly imperfect just when it gets interesting, just when evolutionary change is taking place. This is partly because evolution usually occurred in a different place from where we find most of our fossils. And it is partly because, even if we are fortunate enough to dig in one of the small outlying areas where most evolutionary change went on, that evolutionary change, though still gradual, occupies such a short time that we should need an extra rich fossil record in order to track it."
But no. Instead, they chose, especially in their later writings, in which they were eagerly followed by journalists, to sell their ideas as being radically opposed to Darwin's and opposed to the neo-Darwinian synthesis. They did this by emphasizing the gradualism of the Darwinian view of evolution as opposed to the sudden, jerky, sporadic punctuationism of their own. They even, especially Gould, saw analogies between themselves and the old schools of catastrophism and saltationism. Saltationism we've already discussed. Catastrophism was an 18th and 19th century attempt to reconcile some form of creationism with the uncomfortable facts of the fossil record. Catastrophists believed that the apparent progression of the fossil record really reflected a series of discrete creations, each one terminated by a catastrophic mass extinction. The latest of these catastrophes was Noah's flood. Comparisons between modern punctuationism on the one hand and catastrophism or saltationism on the other have a purely poetic force. They are, if I may coin a paradox, deeply superficial. They sound impressive in an artsy, literary way, but they do nothing to aid serious understanding, and they can give spurious aid and comfort to modern creationists in their disturbingly successful fight to subvert American education and textbook publishing. The fact is that, in the fullest and most serious sense, Eldred and Gould are really just as gradualist as Darwin or any of his followers. It is just that they would compress all the gradual change into brief bursts rather than having it go on all the time, and they emphasize that most of the gradual change goes on in geographical areas away from the areas where most fossils are dug up. So it is not really the gradualism of Darwin that the punctuationists oppose. Gradualism means that each generation is only slightly different from the previous generation. You would have to be a saltationist to oppose that, and Eldred and Gould are not saltationists. Rather, it turns out to be Darwin's alleged belief in the constancy of rates of evolution that they and the other punctuationists object to. They object to it because they think that evolution, still undeniably gradualistic evolution, occurs rapidly during relatively brief bursts of activity, speciation events, which provide a kind of crisis atmosphere in which the alleged normal resistance to evolutionary change is broken. And that evolution occurs very slowly or not at all during long intervening periods of stasis. When we say relatively brief, we mean, of course, brief relative to the geological timescale in general. Even the evolutionary jerks of the punctuationists, though they may be instantaneous by geological standards, still have a duration that is measured in tens or hundreds of thousands of years.
A thought of the famous American evolutionist G. Ledyard Stebbins is illuminating at this point. He isn't specifically concerned with jerky evolution, but is just seeking to dramatize the speed with which evolutionary change can happen when seen against the timescale of available geological time. He imagines a species of animal of about the size of a mouse. He then supposes that natural selection starts to favor an increase in body size, but only very, very slightly. Perhaps larger males enjoy a slight advantage in the competition for females. At any time, males of average size are slightly less successful than males that are a tiny bit bigger than average. Stebbins put an exact figure on the mathematical advantage enjoyed by larger individuals in his hypothetical example. He set it at a value so very, very tiny that it wouldn't be measurable by human observers. And the rate of evolutionary change that it brings about is consequently so slow that it wouldn't be noticed during an ordinary human lifetime. As far as the scientists studying evolution on the ground is concerned, then, these animals are not evolving at all. Nevertheless, they are evolving, very slowly, at a rate given by Stebbins' mathematical assumption, and even at this slow rate, they would eventually reach the size of elephants. How long would this take? Obviously a long time by human standards, but human standards aren't relevant. We are talking about geological time. Stebbins calculates that at his assumed very slow rate of evolution, it would take about 12,000 generations for the animals to evolve from an average weight of 40 grams, mouse size, to an average weight of over 6 million grams, elephant size. Assuming a generation time of 5 years, which is longer than that of a mouse, but shorter than that of an elephant, 12,000 generations would occupy about 60,000 years. 60,000 years is too short to be measured by ordinary geological methods of dating the fossil record. As Stebbins says, the origin of a new kind of animal in 100,000 years or less is regarded by paleontologists as sudden or instantaneous. The punctuationists aren't talking about jumps in evolution, they are talking about episodes of relatively rapid evolution. And even these episodes don't have to be rapid by human standards in order to appear instantaneous by geological standards. Whatever we may think of the theory of punctuated equilibria itself, it is all too easy to confuse gradualism, the belief held by modern punctuationists as well as Darwin, that there are no sudden leaps between one generation and the next, with constant evolutionary speedism, opposed by punctuationists and allegedly, they're not actually, held by Darwin. They are not the same thing at all. The proper way to characterize the beliefs of punctuationists is gradualistic, but with long periods of stasis, evolutionary stagnation, punctuating brief episodes of rapid gradual change. The emphasis is then thrown onto the long periods of stasis as being the previously overlooked phenomenon that really needs explaining. It is the emphasis on stasis that is the punctuationists' real contribution, not their claimed opposition to gradualism, for they are truly as gradualist as anybody else.
Even the emphasis on stasis can be found in less exaggerated form in Meyer's theory of speciation. He believed that, of the two geographically separated races, the original large ancestral population is less likely to change than the new daughter population on the other side of the mountains in the case of our shrew example. This is not just because the daughter population is the one that has moved to new pastures, where conditions are likely to be different and natural selection pressures changed. It is also because there are some theoretical reasons, which Meyer emphasized but whose importance can be disputed, for thinking that large breeding populations have an inherent tendency to resist evolutionary change. A suitable analogy is the inertia of a large, heavy object. It is hard to shift. Small, outlying populations, by virtue of being small, are inherently more likely, so the theory goes, to change, to evolve. Therefore, although I spoke of the two populations or races of shrews as diverging from each other, Meyer would prefer to see the original, ancestral population as relatively static and the new population as diverging from it. The branch of the evolutionary tree does not fork into two equal twigs. Rather, there is a main stem with a side twig sprouting from it. The proponents of punctuated equilibrium took this suggestion of Meyer and exaggerated it into a strong belief that stasis, or lack of evolutionary change, is the norm for a species. They believe that there are genetic forces in large populations that actively resist evolutionary change. Evolutionary change, for them, is a rare event, coinciding with speciation. It coincides with speciation in the sense that, in their view, the conditions under which new species are formed, geographical separation of small, isolated subpopulations, are the very conditions under which the forces that normally resist evolutionary change are relaxed or overthrown. Speciation is a time of upheaval or revolution, and it is during these times of upheaval that evolutionary change is concentrated. For most of the history of a lineage, it stagnates. It isn't true that Darwin believed that evolution proceeded at a constant rate. He certainly didn't believe it in the ludicrously extreme sense that I satirized in my parable of the children of Israel, and I don't think he really believed it in any important sense. Quotation of the following well-known passage from the fourth edition and later editions of The Origin of Species annoys Gould because he thinks it is unrepresentative of Darwin's general thought.
Many species once formed never undergo any further change. And the periods during which species have undergone modification, though long as measured by years, have probably been short in comparison with the periods during which they retain the same form.
Gould wants to shrug off this sentence and others like it, saying,
"You cannot do history by selective quotation and search for qualifying footnotes. General tenor and historical impact are the proper criteria. Did his contemporaries or descendants ever read Darwin as a saltationist?"
Gould is right, of course, about general tenor and historical impact, but the final sentence of this quotation from him is a highly revealing faux pas. Of course nobody has ever read Darwin as a saltationist, and of course Darwin was consistently hostile to saltationism, but the whole point is that saltationism is not the issue when we are discussing punctuated equilibrium. As I've stressed, the theory of punctuated equilibrium, by Eldridge and Gould's own account, is not a saltationist theory. The jumps that it postulates are not real single-generation jumps. They are spread out over large numbers of generations, over periods of, by Gould's own estimation, perhaps tens of thousands of years. The theory of punctuated equilibrium is a gradualist theory, albeit it emphasizes long periods of stasis intervening between relatively short bursts of gradualistic evolution. Gould has misled himself by his own rhetorical emphasis on the purely poetic or literary resemblance between punctuationism on the one hand and true saltationism on the other. I think it would clarify matters if at this point I summarized a range of possible points of view about rates of evolution. Out on a limb, we have true saltationism, which I've already discussed sufficiently. True saltationists don't exist among modern biologists. Everyone that is not a saltationist is a gradualist, and this includes Eldridge and Gould, however they may choose to describe themselves. Within gradualism, we may distinguish various beliefs about rates of gradual evolution. Some of these beliefs, as we've seen, bear a purely superficial, literary or poetic resemblance to true anti-gradualist saltationism, which is why they are sometimes confused with it. At another extreme, we have the sort of constant speedism that I caricatured in the Exodus parable with which I began this chapter. An extreme constant speedist believes that evolution is plodding along steadily and inexorably all the time, whether or not there is any branching or speciation going on. He believes that quantity of evolutionary change is strictly proportional to time elapsed. Ironically, a form of constant speedism has recently become highly favored among modern molecular geneticists. A good case can be made for believing that evolutionary change at the level of protein molecules really does plod along at a constant rate, exactly like the hypothetical children of Israel. And this even if externally visible characteristics, like arms and legs, are evolving in a highly punctuated manner. We've already met this topic in Chapter 5, and I shall mention it again in the next chapter. But as far as adaptive evolution of large-scale structures and behavior patterns are concerned, just about all evolutionists would reject constant speedism, and Darwin certainly would have rejected it. Everyone that is not a constant speedist is a variable speedist. Within variable speedism, we may distinguish two kinds of belief, labeled discrete variable speedism and continuously variable speedism. An extreme discretist not only believes that evolution varies in speed, he thinks that the speed flips abruptly from one discrete level to another, like a car's gearbox. He might believe, for instance, that evolution has only two speeds, very fast and stop. I cannot help being reminded here of the humiliation of my first school report, written by the matron, about my performance as a 7-year-old in folding clothes, taking cold baths, and other daily routines of boarding school life.
Dawkins has only three speeds, slow, very slow, and stop.
Stopped evolution is the stasis that is thought by punctuationists to characterize large populations. Top gear evolution is the evolution that goes on during speciation in small, isolated populations round the edge of large, evolutionarily static populations. According to this view, evolution is always in one or other of the two gears, never in between. Eldridge and Gould tend in the direction of discretism, and in this respect, they are genuinely radical. They may be called discrete variable speedists. Incidentally, there is no particular reason why a discrete variable speedist should necessarily emphasize speciation as the time of high gear evolution. In practice, however, most of them do. Continuously variable speedists, on the other hand, believe that evolutionary rates fluctuate continuously from very fast to very slow and stop, with all intermediates. They see no particular reason to emphasize certain speeds more than others. In particular, stasis, to them, is just an extreme case of ultra-slow evolution. To a punctuationist, there is something very special about stasis. Stasis, to him, is not just evolution that is so slow as to have a rate of zero. Stasis is not just passive lack of evolution because there is no driving force in favor of change. Rather, stasis represents a positive resistance to evolutionary change. It is almost as though species are thought to take active steps not to evolve, in spite of driving forces in favor of evolution.
More biologists agree that stasis is a real phenomenon than agree about its causes. Take an extreme example, the coelacanth latimeria. The coelacanths were a large group of fish, actually, although they're called fish, they're more closely related to us than they are to trout and herrings, that flourished more than 250 million years ago and apparently died out at about the same time as the dinosaurs. Apparently died out because in 1938, much to the zoological world's astonishment, a weird fish, a yard and a half long with unusual leg-like fins, appeared in the catch of a deep-sea fishing boat off the South African coast. Though almost destroyed before its priceless worth was recognized, its decaying remains were fortunately brought to the attention of a qualified South African zoologist just in time. Scarcely able to believe his eyes, he identified it as a living coelacanth and named it Latimeria. Since then, a few other specimens have been fished up in the same area, and the species has now been properly studied and described. It is a living fossil, in the sense that it has changed hardly at all since the time of its fossil ancestors, hundreds of millions of years ago.
So we have stasis. What are we to make of it? How do we explain it? Some of us would say that the lineage leading to Latimeria stood still because natural selection did not move it. In a sense, it had no need to evolve because these animals had found a successful way of life deep in the sea where conditions didn't change much. Perhaps they never participated in any arms races. Their cousins that emerged onto the land did evolve because natural selection, under a variety of hostile conditions, including arms races, forced them to. Other biologists, including some of those that call themselves punctuationists, might say that the lineage leading to modern Latimeria actively resisted change, in spite of what natural selection pressures there might have been. Who is right? In the particular case of Latimeria, it is hard to know, but there is one way in which, in principle, we might go about finding out. Let us, to be fair, stop thinking in terms of Latimeria in particular. It is a striking example, but a very extreme one, and it is not one on which the punctuationists particularly want to rely. Their belief is that less extreme and shorter-term examples of stasis are commonplace, are indeed the norm, because species have genetic mechanisms that actively resist change, even if there are forces of natural selection urging change. Now, here is the very simple experiment which, in principle at least, we can do to test this hypothesis.
We can take wild populations and impose our own forces of selection upon them. According to the hypothesis that species actively resist change, we should find that if we try to breed for some quality, the species should dig in its heels, so to speak, and refuse to budge, at least for a while. If we take cattle and attempt to breed selectively for high milk yield, for instance, we should fail. The genetic mechanisms of the species should mobilize their anti-evolution forces and fight off the pressure to change. If we try to make chickens evolve higher egg-laying rates, we should fail. If bullfighters, in pursuit of their contemptible sport, try to increase the courage of their bulls by selective breeding, they should fail. These failures should only be temporary, of course. Eventually, like a dam bursting under pressure, the alleged anti-evolution forces will be overcome, and the lineage can then move rapidly to a new equilibrium. But we should experience at least some resistance when we first initiate a new program of selective breeding. The fact is, of course, that we do not fail when we try to shape evolution by selectively breeding animals and plants in captivity, nor do we experience a period of initial difficulty. Animal and plant species are usually immediately amenable to selective breeding, and breeders detect no evidence of any intrinsic anti-evolution forces. If anything, selective breeders experience difficulty after a number of generations of successful selective breeding. This is because after some generations of selective breeding, the available genetic variation runs out, and we have to wait for new mutations.
It is conceivable that coelacanths stopped evolving because they stopped mutating, perhaps because they were protected from cosmic rays at the bottom of the sea. But nobody, as far as I know, has seriously suggested this, and in any case this is not what punctuationists mean when they talk of species having built-in resistance to evolutionary change. They mean something more like the point I was making in Chapter 7 about cooperating genes, the idea that groups of genes are so well adapted to each other that they resist invasion by new mutant genes which are not members of the club. This is quite a sophisticated idea, and it can be made to sound plausible. Indeed, it was one of the theoretical props of Meyer's inertia idea, already referred to. Nevertheless, the fact that whenever we try selective breeding, we encounter no initial resistance to it, suggests to me that, if lineages go for many generations in the wild without changing, this is not because they resist change, but because there is no natural selection pressure in favour of changing. They don't change because individuals that stay the same survive better than individuals that change. Punctuationists, then, are really just as gradualist as Darwin or any other Darwinian. They just insert long periods of stasis between spurts of gradual evolution. As I said, The one respect in which punctuationists do differ from other schools of Darwinism is in their strong emphasis on stasis as something positive, as an active resistance to evolutionary change, rather than as simply absence of evolutionary change. And this is the one respect in which they're quite probably wrong. It remains for me to clear up the mystery of why they thought they were so far from Darwin and neo-Darwinism. The answer lies in a confusion of two meanings of the word gradual, coupled with the confusion, which I've been at pains to dispel here, but which lies at the back of many people's minds, between punctuationism and saltationism. Darwin was a passionate anti-saltationist, and this led him to stress over and over again the extreme gradualness of the evolutionary changes that he was proposing. The reason is that saltation, to him, meant what I have called Boeing 747 macromutation. It meant the sudden calling into existence, like Pallas Athene from the head of Zeus, of brand new complex organs at a single stroke of the genetic wand. It meant fully formed, complex working eyes springing up from bare skin in a single generation. The reason it meant these things to Darwin is that that is exactly what it meant to some of his most influential opponents, and they really believed in it as a major factor in evolution.
The Duke of Argyll, for instance, accepted the evidence that evolution had happened, but he wanted to smuggle divine creation in by the back door. He wasn't alone. Instead of a single, once-and-for-all creation in the Garden of Eden, many Victorians thought that the deity had intervened repeatedly at crucial points in evolution. Complex organs like eyes, instead of evolving from simpler ones by slow degrees as Darwin had it, were thought to have sprung into existence in a single instant. Such people rightly perceived that such instant evolution, if it occurred, would imply supernatural intervention. That is what they believed in. The reasons are the statistical ones discussed in connection with hurricanes and Boeing 747s. 747 saltationism is indeed just a watered-down form of creationism.
Putting it the other way around, divine creation is the ultimate in saltation. It is the ultimate leap from inanimate clay to fully formed man. Darwin perceived this too. He wrote in a letter to Sir Charles Lyell, the leading geologist of his day,
"If I were convinced that I required such additions to the theory of natural selection, I would reject it as rubbish. I would give nothing for the theory of natural selection if it requires miraculous additions at any one stage of descent."
This is no petty matter. In Darwin's view, the whole point of the theory of evolution by natural selection was that it provided a non-miraculous account of the existence of complex adaptations. For what it is worth, it is also the whole point of this book. For Darwin, any evolution that had to be helped over the jumps by God was not evolution at all. It made a nonsense of the central point of evolution. In the light of this, it is easy to see why Darwin constantly reiterated the gradualness of evolution. It is easy to see why he wrote that sentence quoted in Chapter 4.
"If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous, successive, slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down."
There is another way of looking at the fundamental importance of gradualness for Darwin. His contemporaries, like many people still today, had a hard time believing that the human body and other such complex entities could conceivably have come into being through evolutionary means.
If you think of the single-celled amoeba as our remote ancestor, as until quite recently it was fashionable to do, many people found it hard in their minds to bridge the gap between amoeba and man. They found it inconceivable that from such simple beginnings, something so complex could emerge. Darwin appealed to the idea of a gradual series of small steps as a means of overcoming this kind of incredulity. You may find it hard to imagine an amoeba turning into a man, the argument runs, but you do not find it hard to imagine an amoeba turning into a slightly different kind of amoeba. From this, it's not hard to imagine it turning into a slightly different kind of, and so on. As we saw in Chapter 3, This argument overcomes our incredulity only if we stress that there was an extremely large number of steps along the way, and only if each step is very tiny. Darwin was constantly battling against this source of incredulity, and he constantly made use of the same weapon, the emphasis on gradual, almost imperceptible change spread out over countless generations.
Incidentally, it is worth quoting J.B.S. Haldane's characteristic piece of lateral thinking in combating the same source of incredulity. Something like the transition from amoeba to man, he pointed out, goes on in every mother's womb in a mere 9 months. Development is admittedly a very different process from evolution, but nevertheless, anyone sceptical of the very possibility of a transition from single cell to man has only to contemplate his own fetal beginnings to have his doubts allayed. I hope I shall not be thought a pedant if I stress, by the way, that the choice of amoeba for the title of honorary ancestor is simply following a whimsical tradition. A bacterium would be a better choice, but even bacteria, as we know them, are modern organisms. To resume the argument, Darwin laid great stress on the gradualness of evolution because of what he was arguing against, the misconceptions about evolution that were prevalent in the 19th century. The meaning of gradual in the context of those times was opposite of saltation. Eldred and Gould, in the context of the late 20th century, use gradual in a very different sense. They, in effect, though not explicitly, use it to mean at a constant speed, and they oppose it to their own notion of punctuation. They criticize gradualism in this sense of constant speedism. No doubt they are right to do so. In its extreme form, it is as absurd as my Exodus parable. But to couple this justifiable criticism with the criticism of Darwin is simply to confuse two quite separate meanings of the word gradual. In the sense in which Eldred and Gould are opposed to gradualism, there is no particular reason to doubt that Darwin would have agreed with them. In the sense of the word in which Darwin was a passionate gradualist, Eldred and Gould are also gradualists. The theory of punctuated equilibrium is a minor gloss on Darwinism, one which Darwin himself might well have approved if the issue had been discussed in his time. As a minor gloss, it does not deserve a particularly large measure of publicity. The reason it has in fact received such publicity, and why I felt obliged to devote a whole chapter of this book to it, is simply that the theory has been sold, oversold by some journalists, as if it were radically opposed to the views of Darwin and his successors. Why has this happened?
There are people in the world who desperately want not to have to believe in Darwinism. They seem to fall into three main classes. First, there are those who, for religious reasons, want evolution itself to be untrue. Second, there are those who have no reason to deny that evolution has happened, but who, often for political or ideological reasons, find Darwin's theory of its mechanism distasteful. Of these, some find the idea of natural selection unacceptably harsh and ruthless. Others confuse natural selection with randomness and hence meaninglessness, which offends their dignity. Yet others confuse Darwinism with social Darwinism, which has racist and other disagreeable overtones. Third, there are people, including many working in what they call, often as a singular noun, the media, who just like seeing apple carts upset, perhaps because it makes good journalistic copy, and Darwinism has become sufficiently established and respectable to be a tempting apple cart.
Whatever the motive, the consequence is that if a reputable scholar breathes so much as a hint of criticism of some detail of current Darwinian theory, the fact is eagerly seized on and blown up out of all proportion. So strong is this eagerness, it is as though there were a powerful amplifier with a finely tuned microphone selectively listening out for anything that sounds the tiniest bit like opposition to Darwinism. This is most unfortunate, for serious argument and criticism is a vitally important part of any science, and it would be tragic if scholars felt the need to muzzle themselves because of the microphones. Needless to say, the amplifier, though powerful, is not hi-fi. There is plenty of distortion. A scientist who cautiously whispers some slight misgiving about a current nuance of Darwinism is liable to hear his distorted and barely recognizable words booming and echoing out through the eagerly waiting loudspeakers. Eldritch and Ghoul don't whisper, they shout, with eloquence and power. What they shout is often pretty subtle, but the message that gets across is that something is wrong with Darwinism. Hallelujah, the scientists said it themselves. The editor of the publication Biblical Creation has written,
"It is undeniable that the credibility of our religious and scientific position has been greatly strengthened by the recent lapse in neo-Darwinian morale. And this is something we must exploit to the full."
Eldritch and Gould have both been doughty champions in the fight against redneck creationism. They have shouted their complaints at the misuse of their own words, only to find that, for this part of their message, the microphone suddenly went dead on them. I can sympathize, for I've had a similar experience with a different set of microphones, in this case politically rather than religiously tuned. What needs to be said now, loud and clear, is the truth that the theory of punctuated equilibrium lies firmly within the neo-Darwinian synthesis. It always did. It will take time to undo the damage wrought by the overblown rhetoric, but it will be undone. The theory of punctuated equilibrium will come to be seen in proportion as an interesting but minor wrinkle on the surface of neo-Darwinian theory. It certainly provides no basis for any lapse in neo-Darwinian morale, and no basis whatever for Gould to claim that the synthetic theory, another name for neo-Darwinism, is effectively dead. It is as if the discovery that the Earth is not a perfect sphere but a slightly flattened spheroid were given banner treatment under the headline,
"Copernicus wrong, flat Earth theory vindicated."
But to be fair, Gould's remark was aimed not so much at the alleged gradualism of the Darwinian synthesis as at another of its claims. This is the claim, which Eldridge and Gould dispute, that all evolution, even on the grandest geological timescale, is an extrapolation of events that take place within populations or species. They believe that there is a higher form of selection, which they call species selection. I'm deferring this topic to the next chapter. The next chapter is also the place to deal with another school of biologists who, on equally flimsy grounds, have in some cases been passed off as anti-Darwinian, the so-called transformed cladists. These belong within the general field of taxonomy, the science of classification. Chapter 10. The One True Tree of Life. This book is mainly about evolution as the solution of the complex design problem, evolution as the true explanation for the phenomena that Paley thought proved the existence of a divine watchmaker. This is why I keep going on about eyes and echolocation. But there is another whole range of things that the theory of evolution explains. These are the phenomena of diversity, the pattern of different animal and plant types distributed around the world, and the distribution of characteristics among them. Although I am mainly concerned with eyes and other pieces of complex machinery, I mustn't neglect this other aspect of evolution's role in helping us to understand nature. So this chapter is about taxonomy. Taxonomy is the science of classification. For some people, it has an undeservedly dull reputation, a subconscious association with dusty museums and the smell of preserving fluid, almost as though it were being confused with taxidermy. In fact, it is anything but dull. It is, for reasons that I do not fully understand, one of the most acrimoniously controversial fields in all of biology. It is of interest to philosophers and historians. It has an important role to play in any discussion of evolution. And from within the ranks of taxonomists have come some of the most outspoken of those modern biologists who pretend to be anti-Darwinian. Although taxonomists mostly study animals or plants, all sorts of other things can be classified. Rocks, warships, books in a library, stars, languages. Orderly classification is often represented as a measure of convenience, a practical necessity, and this is indeed a part of the truth. The books in a large library are nearly useless unless they are organized in some non-random way so that books on a particular subject can be found when you want them. The science, or it may be an art, of librarianship is an exercise in applied taxonomy. For the same kind of reason, biologists find their life made easier if they can pigeonhole animals and plants in agreed categories with names. But to say that this is the only reason for animal and plant taxonomy would be to miss most of the point. For evolutionary biologists, there is something very special about the classification of living organisms, something that is not true of any other kind of taxonomy. It follows from the idea of evolution that there is one uniquely correct branching family tree of all living things, and we can base our taxonomy upon it. In addition to its uniqueness, this taxonomy has the singular property that I shall call perfect nesting. What this means, and why it is so important, is a major theme of this chapter.
Let us use the library as an example of non-biological taxonomy. There is no single, unique, correct solution to the problem of how the books in a library or a bookshop should be classified. One librarian might divide his collection up into the following major categories: science, history, literature, other arts, foreign works, etc. Each of these major departments of the library would be subdivided. The science wing of the library might have subdivisions into biology, geology, chemistry, physics, and so on. The books in the biology section of the science wing might be subdivided into shelves devoted to physiology, anatomy, biochemistry, entomology, and so on. Finally, within each shelf, the books might be housed in alphabetical order. Other major wings of the library, the history wing, the literature wing, the foreign language wing, and so on, would be subdivided in similar ways. The library is, therefore, hierarchically divided in a way that makes it possible for a reader to home in on the book that he wants. Hierarchical classification is convenient because it enables the borrower to find his way around the collection of books quickly. It is for the same kind of reason that the words in dictionaries are arranged in alphabetical order. But there is no unique hierarchy by which the books in a library must be arranged. A different librarian might choose to organize the same collection of books in a different but still hierarchical way. He might not, for instance, have a separate foreign language wing, but might prefer to house books, regardless of language, in their appropriate subject areas. German biology books in the biology section, German history books in the history section, and so on. A third librarian might adopt the radical policy of housing all books, on whatever subject, in chronological order of publication, relying on card indexes, or computer equivalents, to find books on desired topics.
These three library plans are quite different from each other, but they would probably all work adequately and would be thought acceptable by many readers, though not, incidentally, by the choleric elderly London clubman whom I once heard on the radio berating his club's committee for employing a librarian. The library had gone on for 100 years without organisation, and he didn't see why it needed organising now. The interviewer mildly asked him how he thought the books ought to be arranged. "Tallest on the left, shortest on the right," he roared without hesitation. Popular bookshops classify their books into major sections that reflect popular demand. Instead of science, history, literature, geography, and so on, their major departments are gardening, cookery, TV titles, the occult, and I once saw a shelf prominently labelled Religion and UFOs.
So there is no correct solution to the problem of how to classify books. Librarians can have sensible disagreements with one another about classification policy, but the criteria by which arguments are won or lost will not include the truth or correctness of one classification system relative to another. Rather, the criteria that are bandied about in argument will be convenience for library users, speed of finding books, and so on. In this sense, the taxonomy of books in a library can be said to be arbitrary. This doesn't imply that it is unimportant to devise a good classification system, far from it. What it does mean is that there is no single classification system which, in a world of perfect information, would be universally agreed as the only correct classification. The taxonomy of living creatures, on the other hand, as we shall see, does have this strong property that the taxonomy of books lacks. At least it does if we take up an evolutionary standpoint.
It is, of course, possible to devise any number of systems for classifying living creatures, but I shall show that all but one of these are just as arbitrary as any librarian's taxonomy. If it is simply convenience that is required, a museum keeper might classify his specimens according to size and keeping conditions. Large stuffed specimens, small dried specimens pinned on cork boards in trays, pickled ones in bottles, microscopic ones on slides, and so on. Such groupings of convenience are common in zoos. In the London Zoo, rhinos are housed in the elephant house, for no better reason than that they need the same kind of stoutly fortified cages as elephants. An applied biologist might classify animals into harmful, subdivided into medical pests, agricultural pests, and directly dangerous biters or stingers, beneficial, subdivided in similar ways, and neutral. A nutritionist might classify animals according to the food value of their meat to humans, again with elaborate subdivision of categories. My grandmother once embroidered a cloth book about animals for children, which classified them by their feet. Anthropologists have documented numerous elaborate systems of animal taxonomy used by tribes around the world. But of all the systems of classification that could be dreamed up, there is one unique system, unique in the sense that words like correct and incorrect, true and false, can be applied to it with perfect agreement, given perfect information. That unique system is the system based on evolutionary relationships. To avoid confusion, I shall give this system the name that biologists give to its strictest form, cladistic taxonomy.
In cladistic taxonomy, the ultimate criterion for grouping organisms together is closeness of cousinship, or in other words, relative recency of common ancestry. Birds, for instance, are distinguished from non-birds by the fact that they are all descended from a common ancestor which is not an ancestor of any non-bird. Mammals are all descended from a common ancestor which is not an ancestor of any non-mammal. Birds and mammals have a more remote common ancestor which they share with lots of other animals, like snakes and lizards and tuataras. The animals descended from this common ancestor are all called amniotes. So birds and mammals are amniotes. Reptiles is not a true taxonomic term, according to cladists, because it is defined by exception, all amniotes except birds and mammals. In other words, the most recent common ancestor of all reptiles, snakes, turtles, etc., is also ancestral to some non-reptiles, namely birds and mammals. Within mammals, rats and mice share a recent common ancestor with each other. Leopards and lions share a recent common ancestor with each other. So do chimpanzees and humans with each other. Closely related animals are animals that share a recent common ancestor. More distantly related animals share an earlier common ancestor. Very distantly related animals, like people and slugs, share a very early common ancestor. Organisms can never be totally unrelated to one another, since it is all but certain that life as we know it originated only once on Earth.
True cladistic taxonomy is strictly hierarchical, an expression which I shall use to mean that it can be represented as a tree whose branches always diverge and never converge again. In my view, some schools of taxonomists that we shall discuss later would disagree, it is strictly hierarchical not because hierarchical classification is convenient, like a librarian's classification, nor because everything in the world falls naturally into a hierarchical pattern, but simply because the pattern of evolutionary descent is hierarchical. Once the tree of life has branched beyond a certain minimum distance, basically the bounds of the species, the branches never ever come together again. There may be exceptions, especially in bacteria and in the origin of the eukaryotic cell, mentioned in Chapter 7. Birds and mammals are descended from a common ancestor, but they are now separate branches of the evolutionary tree, and they will never come together again. There will never be a hybrid between a bird and a mammal. A group of organisms that has this property of all being descended from a common ancestor, which is not an ancestor of any non-member of the group, is called a clade, after the Greek for a tree branch.
Another way of representing this idea of strict hierarchy is in terms of perfect nesting. We write the names of any set of animals on a large sheet of paper and draw rings around related sets. For example, rat and mouse would be united in a small ring indicating that they are close cousins with a recent common ancestor. Guinea pig and capybara would be united with each other in another small ring. The rat-mouse ring and the guinea pig-capybara ring would, in turn, be united with each other, and beavers and porcupines and squirrels and lots of other animals, in a larger ring labelled with its own name, rodents. Inner rings are said to be nested inside larger outer rings. Somewhere else on the paper, lion and tiger would be united with one another in a small ring. This ring would be included with others in a ring labelled cats. Cats, dogs, weasels, bears, etc. would all be united in a series of rings within rings in a single large ring labelled carnivores. The rodent ring and the carnivore ring would then take part in a more global series of rings within rings in a very large ring labelled mammals. The important thing about this system of rings within rings is that it is perfectly nested. Never, not on a single solitary occasion, will the rings that we draw intersect each other. Take any two overlapping rings, and it will always be true to say that one lies wholly inside the other. The area enclosed by the inner one is always totally enclosed by the outer one. There are never any partial overlaps. This property of perfect taxonomic nesting is not exhibited by books, languages, soil types, or schools of thought in philosophy. If a librarian draws a ring around the biology books and another ring around the theology books, he will find that the two rings overlap. In the zone of overlap are books with titles like Biology and Christian Belief. On the face of it, we might expect the classification of languages to exhibit the property of perfect nesting. Languages, as we saw in Chapter 8, evolve in a rather animal-like way. Languages that have recently diverged from a common ancestor, like Swedish, Norwegian, and Danish, are much more similar to each other than they are to languages that diverged longer ago, like Icelandic. But languages don't only diverge, they also merge. Modern English is a hybrid between Germanic and Romance languages that had diverged much earlier, and English would therefore not fit neatly in any hierarchical nesting diagram. The rings that enclosed English would be found to intersect, to overlap partially. Biological classificatory rings never intersect in this way because biological evolution above the species level is always divergent.
Once again, bacteria are an exception. Returning to the library example, no librarian can entirely avoid the problem of intermediates or overlaps. It is no use housing the biology and theology sections next door to each other and putting intermediate books in the corridor between them. For what then do we do with books that are intermediate between biology and chemistry, between physics and theology, history and theology, history and biology? I think I'm right in saying that the problem of intermediates is inescapably, inherently, a part of all taxonomic systems other than that which springs from evolutionary biology. Speaking personally, it is a problem that gives me almost physical discomfort when I am attempting the modest filing tasks that arise in my professional life, shelving my own books and reprints of scientific papers that colleagues, with the kindest of intentions, send me, filing administrative papers, old letters, and so on. Whatever categories one adopts for a filing system, there are always awkward items that don't fit, and the uncomfortable indecision leads me, I'm sorry to say, to leave odd papers out on the table, sometimes for years at a time, until it is safe to throw them away. Often, one has unsatisfactory recourse to a miscellaneous category, a category which, once initiated, has a menacing tendency to grow. I sometimes wonder whether librarians and keepers of all museums, except biological museums, are particularly prone to ulcers.
In the taxonomy of animals and plants, these filing problems do not arise. There are no miscellaneous animals. As long as we stay above the level of the species, and as long as we study only modern animals, or animals in any given time slice, as we shall see, there are no awkward intermediates. If an animal appears to be an awkward intermediate, say it seems to be exactly intermediate between a mammal and a bird, an evolutionist can be confident that it must definitely be one or the other. The appearance of intermediacy must be an illusion. The unlucky librarian can take no such reassurance. It is perfectly possible for a book to belong simultaneously in both the history and the biology departments. Cladistically inclined biologists never indulge in any librarian's arguments over whether it is convenient to classify whales as mammals or as fish.